You're listening to a download from theoutdoorstation.co.uk. Number 503.
Hello and welcome back to The Outdoor Station, producers of podcasts since 2005, dedicated to the self-powered outdoors traveller. I'm your host, Bob Cartwright, and this slightly longer than usual interview is with the only bespoke, lightweight pack manufacturer in the country. Think about that for a second. As you'll hear, there's numerous reasons for this, and as us enthusiasts know, it's one thing to make your own gear with a small amount of material you can obtain from the two wholesalers in the UK. However, setting up a commercial cottage industry takes commitment, considerable investment, loads of risk, and let's face it, a bucket full of guts. But before we speak to Tom Gale from Atom Packs, I want to welcome those who have joined my newsletter this week. And that includes Louise Padalopoulos, Brian Hall, Ken All, Keith Ames Rook, Ryan King, who celebrates the podcast with Abby Barnes, with an exclamation mark, David Stevens, Jason Hornsby, Stephen Coward, Dolly Chi, Alan Redford and Mark Wayne. So welcome one and all. And if you haven't joined the newsletter, please do pop by theoutdoorstation.co.uk and add your name and any details so you'll be the first to hear about some of the new developments in 2020. Okay, so now let's hear Tom's journey from student with no particular direction through to hiker, to then completing the Triple Crown, gathering numerous outdoor qualifications along the way, using a sewing machine for the first time, through to where he is today. It's a fascinating journey, and one which started only 10 years ago.
So yeah, I found out about the Appalachian Trail at the tail end of 2007, and I read Bill Bryson's book and was just sort of immediately interested in being occupied for 6 months, and sort of having a goal and a purpose. And my best friend's dad was terminally ill with prostate cancer at the time, and so we were looking for a sort of larger trip to do that we could potentially fundraise on, and the Appalachian Trail seemed sort of perfect, really. And then when I typed it into Google, I ended up on White Blaze, which was the forum back then. It obviously still exists, but I was suddenly amazed that there was this wealth of information and all this stuff. And suddenly everyone was like, "Oh, you know, you want to be a lightweight backpacker? You know, you can't have a backpack that sort of weighs more than sort of 1.5 kilos." It was about the lightest thing on the market then, that was sort of off the shelf. Then the Osprey Exos came out in sort of late 2008, and that's what I ended up taking on the hike. And at the time, you know, that was like a fully featured 46-liter pack that weighed, I think it was 1.2 kilos. And I remember picking it up and thinking, like, wow, this is the lightest thing and the most expensive thing to date that I'd ever bought. I paired that with, once we sort of set off on the trail, obviously, you know, despite best intentions, you end up packing your fears, and we had way too much stuff. And began the long process of replacing every single piece of kit bar the backpack over the course of this sort of 2,200-mile hike.
Can I just ask you, where were you before you started to do this then? Had you sort of been, were you a student? Had you just finished college or something? And had you just sort of had a normal Duke of Edinburgh, should we say, type background?
So I never did the Duke of Edinburgh, but I went to like an engineering college and didn't really get on too well with it, and then spent sort of a couple of years intending to go to university but never quite making it. I think I knew that I needed to burn off a bit of energy and to sort of, I don't want to say find myself, but work out who I was going to be as a person, because I knew, I think knowing myself, I'd messed around a lot at school and I knew that a university education would have been wasted on that guy, who'd have probably just ended up with a lot of debt and some hazy memories. So I was really just sort of mooching around. I'd been working in I've been running an ice cream van for somebody on the beaches of North Cornwall and surfing a lot and just not really doing very much, to be honest, just sort of mooching around and trying to find my way. The trail really felt like a big step out into the unknown. I was 21 and I thought I was the wisest, most erudite man alive. But obviously, you know, I look back at the boy who I was and laugh heartily. But
so it really was a focusing experience then, the whole process of, and presumably the people you met as along the way, as well as the information you picked up from White Blaze.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's, you know, all these forums have got incredible amounts of information on them, to almost too much to the point. And there's a lot of opinions, and some of them well founded, some of them not so. So it's kind of really picking through the noise. And then actually, once you're out on trail, it's so much easier to, because you're doing it and you're out there and you're, you know, that is your life for 6 months. It really sharpens your focus to, right, this is what I need, this is what I don't need, and everything else can go. So that was kind of the process of sort of lightening the pack load was pretty continuous, and also learning really how to move in that environment.
So what did you start with and what did you finish with then, as regards, you know, you arrived at the start point with your Osprey full of everything that you realized you didn't need in the end. So what did you end up with? I'm just curious to know what the difference was in your words between the beginning and the end.
Well, I think especially, you know, I had no idea what, you know, I genuinely thought one of us was going to die on that trip. And that's how little I knew. I hadn't really done, I'd done a lot of research into like the gear, but I hadn't really done that much sort of long distance walking to that point. So I was very new against all of that. So I thought, you know, a 2.5 kilo tent was perfectly fine. despite the fact that I did own a lighter one, I elected to go with the bigger, heavier one. So I had like this, North Face Tadpole tent. I had like a North Face, duvet jacket that probably weighed as much as my sleeping bag. It's also just like not knowing. I know that in England in April it can get really cold, and you know, I started the Appalachian Trail on the, I think, 21st of April, and you know, it was boiling hot. Like you know, I was completely blown away by how hot it was, and how unprepared I was for that heat, just because I was expecting it to still be freezing. So you know, there was a lot of extra stuff that got jettisoned within the first sort of couple of weeks. And then by the time I got to the end, so I'd say at the beginning I probably had at least, I think my pack at the border weighed 45 pounds. So what's that, like 20, it's like 18 kilos, isn't it? I remember having like 6 liters of water. There was as much stuff strapped to the outside of my bag as there was to the inside. And by the time I got to the end, I sort of learned to, you know, on the Appalachian Trail, there's water absolutely everywhere. So you only ever really need to carry about a liter. And I developed quite a good strategy for just drinking a liter at each water source and then filling up a liter. And then that way between each water source, I was drinking 2 liters. And, you know, just little things like that, like those little strategies that you pick up along the way to sort of, you know, minimize the amount of sort of wasted effort of moving in that environment.
And so what did you finish with then as a comparison?
Finished with probably, I think my base weight was about 17 pounds, which is still quite high. But, you know, I think I had, you know, my tent was lighter, my bag, my sleeping bag was lighter, just everything was lighter. It was just, I think, yeah, like I say, I rebought every single piece of gear. But in terms of exact figures, I think I probably lost about 50% of my overall base weight. But also, you know, I absolutely was not eating enough on that trail. I hadn't really worked out how to feed myself properly. whereas now, you know, I know that, you know, I at rest, I eat 4,000 calories a day. You know, I'm a big guy and I run quite fast, or, you know, I run like quite a high metabolism. So, I need quite a lot of food. And I think on the Appalachian Trail, I lost about 2 stone, which offer, you know, a skinny 14 stone frame isn't really, you know, there's not much space for me to lose that type of weight.
So it was a real birth of fire then. You really did dip your toes right up to your neck in the hot water and come out of that 6 months experience a lot more experienced and wiser.
Yeah.
So what was your approach then? Because I know you went on to do the Teora in 2013, a couple of years later. What happened during that gap in that time? Were you sort of looking at the outdoors world and with different eyes because of that experience?
So when I finished the AT, I knew I wanted to sort of have the outdoors as a focus of my life. You know, I wanted as much as I could for that to be a part of every day. So I began a process of getting trained up in the outdoors, which took me a couple of years actually to find the right sort of path. So obviously I came off the AT in 09. I think I spent 2010 and 2011 working in a cheese shop in Bath, which was fun. But, you know, then I ended up working as an outdoor educator, as an apprentice outdoor instructor. I then went on to do another apprenticeship, this time in Keswick in the Lake District, working this time for a local education authority, which was, you know, they're well known for providing, you know, a much more intense variety of outdoor learning for children. And so through that, I got sort of qualified. I got a few sort of, they're known as National Governing Body Awards, or NGBs. So I got a few NGBs in sort of, what did I get? I managed to get my mountain leader certification, my summer mountain leader, which entitles you to sort of be able to lead and guide people out into wilderness environments around the UK on, you know, open-ended expeditions, basically. So that was kind of it, really. I was just sort of very focused on sort of moving, getting as qualified as I could and becoming an outdoor leader. And you know, in that time, my navigation became, you know, obviously much, much better. And my sort of group management as well, like learning how to manage groups in that sort of dynamic, changing mountainous environment. So I was a very different person on the Appalachian, on the TRO, than I was on the Appalachian Trail. Very, very different.
But looking to where you've ended up now, and obviously we'll come on to that in a minute, but looking to where you ended up now, you know, you think about the experience of this student, for the best of words, that went into doing the AT, that came out much wiser as regards saw things in practice over a long period of time, and then going through the qualifications, qualifications aside, you were also meeting people and looking at their equipment, whether it was consciously or subconsciously, and probably learning a lot about the way people approach the outdoors with the equipment they've got.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think there's no nerdier, more sort of interested bunch of people than sort of outdoor enthusiasts. I think everyone's constantly sort of pawning over the new piece of climbing gear or you know, whatever it be. So, you know, this gear does surround us, and how people use it is sort of, you know, I used to work with a variety of different instructors, some of whom had massive great big backpacks and carrying loads and loads of gear, but you know, they were 45, 50 years old, and they were moaning that their backs were knackered because they'd been doing it for 30 years. And then there was a lot of younger lads who were like, right, well, you know, I don't want to be that guy. I've got a pack lighter. So yeah, I remember sort of, I'd like rock up with my like teeny tiny bag that still had all the relevant sort of safety equipment in it, and people's eyes would kind of bulge out. But again, in that environment, it's hard to not pack your fears when you are the leader. You know, when you are taking, you know, a group of clients onto the summit of Scarfell Pike at 3 o'clock in the morning in, you know, an autumn storm. You know, you can have terrible conditions up there, so it's like you sort of can't really be ultralight in that environment. I suppose there's a time and a place for it, and you know, at the expense of other people's safety is when it becomes sort of an unacceptable risk, I suppose.
No, but I you know, stepping aside, a wealth of experience, which all adds up to where we're going. So you went on to New Zealand and to do the trail there. Obviously, a completely different approach, I guess, from the AT when you first started on day one of the AT. So can you just give us a synopsis of how that went for you, what you started with, what you finished with?
So the Tiro was... yeah, I mean, I went out there with my girlfriend at the time, Nicola, and that was her first through hike. You know, she'd never done any walking before. She'd previously, you know, moaned the entire way up Catbells and was famed for not being much of a hiker. She was very much a winter paddler or a whitewater rafter. And, you know, she was very accomplished on that side of things. And so we went out there, and it was actually this epic adventure because, you know, there was only 40 people, I think, in the year that we hiked it. There was only 40 people that attempted, and I don't know how many of those got to the end. But the trail was very raw. It had only been open for 3 years or three seasons, and yeah. So we were heading down these trails that perhaps 100 people had walked in the last sort of 3 or 4 years. So you know, it was a bit of a fight at times to get through places, to find the information. You know, we had these trail notes that were I downloaded them onto a Kindle because that was like, I didn't have a smartphone at the time. So that was the lightest way I could carry sort of, you know, 180 days worth of information. And yeah, so it was a bit of a learning curve really to learn how to, you know, to navigate and to be able to sort of just take care of ourselves out there, because it was dangerous. You know, two people died, or one Tiro hiker died, and one guy who was just section hiking, he disappeared, never to be seen again. So, and that was in the year that we were there. And you know, the environment there is harsh. Like, you know, you can die 2 kilometers from a road, and we can die 1 kilometer from a road. It's a very serious place, and the weather changes very quickly, and actually the hardships are quite hard. And the sort of New Zealand attitude is kind of like oh yeah, it'll be all right, like off you go. And actually, you know, these trails were really quite unsafe in places. And you know, you kind of get to this point and you're like, well, do we keep going? And it's like, well, I don't want to go back through what we've, you know, you might be 4 days into like a 10-day section and you hit something that's potentially unpassable, but you've got through 15 unpassable obstacles to get to where you are. So it's like, right, well, do we keep going? Like, at what point do we turn back? And luckily we always managed to press on. And you know, there's amazing apps out there now that, you know, gut hooks, you can just basically, you know, all the information's there. We had no water information or anything other than what was on the maps. So yeah, I was navigating hard the entire way. I think I probably looked at my map 15 times a kilometer, probably. Like, it was nearly always in my hand. Especially once we got into the South Island, and you know, we were just sort of it was tough, but you know, it was such an incredible adventure, and because of that hardship, it was wonderful, one of the best experiences I've had.
And what about the your approach to gear for that one after your previous experience and what you'd learned in the years in between?
Yeah, so we were hiking with again, I took my trusty Osprey Axos from the Appalachian Trail, despite the fact that Osprey had actually kindly given me a new one after I told them how much I loved my old one. I had it out there, but I didn't use it. And this thing was—I was just nursing this pack along, like, you know, the strap had like torn clean in half, and you know, the frame was like bulging out of it, and it was knackered. But I really wanted to get it past 5,000 miles, and I did. So, but you know, we were hiking as a pair, we were able to shed a little bit more weight because we had certain shared items like the tent and, you know, we had a big sleeping bag that we slept in and that kind of thing. So, you know, that all makes a difference when you're hiking with another person. Because, yeah, you sort of get these economies of scale where you can end up with twice the tent for 2/3 the weight, you know.
And what about your girlfriend? Because you said she wasn't a great lover of that before she started. I presume she cheered up before the end?
She did, yeah. She went on to, she's now, we hiked the Pacific Crest Trail together in 2015, and and she went on to hike the Great Divide Trail, which is the northern part of the Rocky Mountains from Waterton Park up to, I don't know where it terminates, but it's about 800 miles through Canada. Yeah, she now lives out there and she's training up as a ski patrol guide. In some amazing ski resort out there. So yeah, her life has changed a lot since we met, and I think through hiking's obviously been a huge part of that. I think it's hard to imagine through hiking not fundamentally changing the core of your being. I think it's one of the most rewarding things you can do.
Podcasting around the world. It's all about getting out and having much more fun. This is the Outdoor Station.
So after this period of time then, the 2013-2015, is this now the time where you started to look at making your own packs? And was it merely just a whim, a sort of a hobby that got you going? And did you then test it on the CDT? Or tell me the history there.
So, yeah, I'm an incredibly curious person. Like I find it very difficult to sit still and or do nothing. My resting mind is naturally very inquisitive. So I was on the Tierra when I met, there were sort of two people that I came across. There was one hiker named Gerald who had this insanely lightweight backpack, and I couldn't understand, you know, I had a lot of the same gear as him, and I was just like, why is his pack so much tinier than mine? He had this minuscule Laufbursch, I don't know what it was, but it was utterly tiny. It weighed like 300 grams. It was like a day pack. And, it looked like a little school bag. and it was actually when I was looking at that, that I was like, God, this is simply made. And I was like, you know, I'd never sewn a stitch before. And I thought, you know what, I think maybe I could do this. If one day I find a sewing machine and somebody that's willing to teach me, I think maybe I could have a go. And then actually when we finished the trail, another hiker that we'd met, we went back to go and stay with him. And he did a long section, a guy named Cam, he did a long section of the TRO before deciding he wanted to do the Pacific Crest Trail, and went back to his home in Christchurch and cut up his tarp and made a sort of rough backpack out of it. And the frame was built out of like part of a one of those laundry areas that you have, like a clothes horse, do you call it? It was you know, he'd literally sawn this thing up and put that in as the frame, and you know, it was properly rough. But I was like, if this, you know, 6'2" gnarly dreaded bearded man can learn to sew, I think definitely I can. So actually with his impetus, or with him as kind of a bit of encouragement, I then, you know, when I got home was sort of happy enough to sort of go and try and make mistakes on my own gear. So we came back. We were living with we moved in with a girl, and she had a sewing machine just sitting on it. She was quite a crafty girl, Susie, and she was always sewing stuff, and one day I asked her to show me the ropes, and that's what got me in this mess.
They're clever machines, aren't they, sewing machines? I have to say, I think they were invented in the Victorian era or before, but somebody's mind was absolutely phenomenal to work out the mechanics of sewing.
Yeah, I mean, some of the, you know, once you get into the really high-end machinery, you know, we're lucky enough to have some very sort of top-of-the-range gear here, and you know, the price difference between, you know, a sort of generic sewing machine and then one that operates as what's called like a unison feed. So where the top and the bottom feed mechanism all kind of work together, and, you know, they are insanely complicated things, and, you know, you do pay for them at a certain level. But the fact that you can sort of go into Argos and pick one up for 80 quid or less is quite remarkable. You know, anybody can really, you know, start stitching for under £100, like you know, car boot sales and that kind of thing.
So let's move on to your sewing education then, because I know you've had a lot of input from different people, apart from obviously the lady that taught you to get going. And no doubt you've had lots of ups and downs regarding the qualities of the items that you were making. Tell me a bit more about how you've got from that beginner, which was, what, in 2014-ish, would that be right?
Yeah, so let's think, 2014, I probably stitched... Yeah, 2014, I stitched my first packs, and then 2015, I took some onto the Pacific Crest Trail, and then, yeah, so, you know, the fact that, you know, I could, the third and fourth packs that I ever made, we actually took out to the Pacific Crest Trail, and, you know, this was with Nicola again, and we hiked, I did the whole thing with mine, and she did about... I think she picked hers up about 500 miles up the trail. And yeah, so we, you know, the fact that we could take those packs that were really rough, you know, they were not well made, but they survived. I think we had one seam blowout, and that was because I'd used like a cotton thread or something, and it had just rotted basically, and it was what was holding the hip belt in. So yeah, that blew out, but you know, the joy of having made something is you know how to fix it. So, yeah, just with some dental floss and some needles on the side of the trail, we managed to put it right. So, those packs survived that trip with a little bit of doctoring and a little bit of assistance. And I'm pretty sure they'd do the same journey again. So, you know, there's really very little stopping people. But what is hard is when you try and then charge somebody for that. You know, the finishing is something that really, really took a lot of time. And, you know, even in 2016, the start of 2016, I was back off the PCT, and I'd spent the winter, you know, designing a few packs, and I'd even gone out to France to do a ski season, and I'd taken my sewing machine out there with me. And, but I still wasn't good enough. You know, you know, people were very polite. Like, you know, when you're just like, oh, you know, I made this, they're like, oh, well, that's very good. But actually, when you look at it closely, it's like, yeah, it looks like a 6'7" guy has made that that can't sew. It was that year when we got back to the Lake District. I used to buy materials from Adrian at Aguil Alpine Equipment, who are they build a lot of very hard wearing gear. They're probably one of those sort of original cottage industry companies in the UK. And yeah, no, fortuitously, I ended up sort of working with him sort of three days a week for about 8 months, and that really was to be able to get that level of practice on somebody else's fabric and on somebody else's dollar was absolutely amazing, because you know that would have taken me, you know, I think I sold up until that point I think I'd sold 8 backpacks maybe, so. You know, suddenly I was making 10 backpacks a week and, you know, really actually honing those skills. The packs I was making for him were very simple, but there was a lot, all the processes that we use now, I learned on his machines and, you know, creating those, you know, the shoulder straps and, you know, just the way you can manipulate fabric and, you know, everything about it. You know, I wouldn't say necessarily that, I was coached that much by him. He just gave me the opportunity to sort of practice really and make mistakes and learn from those mistakes.
But it's like the AT, isn't it? You're in a place where focusing is actually the most important part of your day. You know, you can't just meander off and go and check Facebook. It's like, right, I'm here, I'm doing it. And practice makes perfect, as they say.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there's definitely a shift. Nicola's still got the two packs that I made for her. Well, I assume she's still got them, but they're the sort of missing links in the sort of the Atom Packs history, really, where it sort of went from like, you know, okay to sellable. and even when I look back at gear that we made, you know, but at the beginning of last year, it was, while, you know, I was still stand by the fact that I sold it, you know, I was still happy to sell it at the time. You know, what we're making now is, you know, 1,000 packs down the line is even more honed and even more sort of well finished. So it's, you know, it's a process that's constantly ongoing, you know, even today, you know, I tried a different form of elasticating the pocket on the Prospector pack, which we've currently taken off the website, and I'm getting quite a lot of hate mail about. But the fact was that it's a really, really complicated pack to actually sew, and the girls both all hate doing it, and to the point that, you know, it takes an extra hour to make one versus one of our other packs because of the risk factor that's involved in it. And so I was like, right, how can we get around this? So today we tried a completely different way of elasticating the top. And it's like, not only does it look better, it's easier to sew. And I think actually the product's better as a result. So, you know, suddenly it's like, right, well, this is standard now on everything that we're going to send out. Like, that's the beauty of having, you know, complete control of your production, is the best idea is just the best idea. And it's like, you can constantly have better ones. So, yeah, it's obviously sort of still kind of ongoing, really.
So tell me then the process from working those 3 days a week for Adrian to where you are. Well, not so much now, because obviously now you've got quite an efficient team and a sort of a bigger business, as it were. But what the process that took you from that 2 or 3 days a week working with somebody else to going, okay, I can confidently start a business with a solid range of products now?
So I went off. So at the end of 2016, I left a grill and moved back home for a bit after a bit of a sort of tough family time, and after a pretty hard couple of months, I was like, do you know what, I have to get out on trail again. Like, I need this. And I had my sewing machine with me the whole time. By this point, I was stitching on like a proper industrial machine, and so I was like, right, I want to launch this company. Like, I think I'm ready to do it, but there's the Continental Divide Trail. And years ago, I was like, if I can get the Triple Crown by the time I'm 30, if I can get those trails ticked off, then I think that's that itch scratched. You know, I can be content with that for the next few years until obviously I have to do the next hike. But what I didn't want to do was launch the company and then stop. And then go and hike the Continental Divide. So I was like, right, you know, I've had a really hard year. Let's, you know, design a few packs. We'll get out on trail. We'll test them. I was like, let's try and get sort of 10,000 miles of testing done. So I found sort of two or three people that were happy to sort of test sacks for me. So I sat and made those, and then went out on trail, and then just had an absolute, you know, blast on the CDT for, I think we were out there for about 5.5 months. And then when I came home, you know, I got a load of fabric delivered to my friend's house in Seattle, and I unrolled it off all the rolls and folded it all up into a 100-liter duffel bag and snuck it back on the plane. And instead of getting depressed post trail, I just built backpacks. And I think I got back in October, and I launched the company in February. I think February 2nd, which was my birthday, was the day I took my first sale. So I must have spent about two and a half months designing like the core range, and then, you know, being like, right, you know, I'm at some point I'm gonna have to just tell people that I'm doing this. You know, so I found out about Reddit and just went onto Reddit, and just I'd never been on this like Reddit ultralight forum before, and I immediately just posted about the backpacks, and it immediately got taken down. But then I managed to it sort of launched it from there, really. Like the Reddit sale was actually one of the best decisions I think we ever made, because we were the first person, we were the first company that had. They ended up one of the moderators of that forum got in touch and said, look, you know, there's no cottage companies in Europe anymore. Let's if you can offer, you know, 10% off or a discount code, then we'll let you do a post about your new website. And that's what we ended up doing. We offered 10% off all new orders, and within like the first week and a half, I think we'd taken about 30 orders. You know, this website that I just built, knowing absolutely nothing about websites, it got like 1600 hits in one day. And, you know, it was quite a contentious post on Reddit as well, because a lot of those guys were like, ah, God, you know, this guy's going to be, you know, constantly posting about all his gear. But, you know, the reaction was actually really positive. And you know, when we moved, it was suddenly enough to be like, right, actually, I think that I've got enough orders here that I don't necessarily need to work. And actually, I can't work because I've got these orders to make. And luckily, they sort of kept coming in. And you know, so the guiding work that I'd booked out for that year, I ended up cancelling nearly all of it within the first sort of 3 months, because I was just like, I cannot get away from this. Like, I was just manacled to a sewing machine for up until about May, I think.
You mentioned we a few times there. What did we consist of at that time?
Oh, sorry. So I struggle talking about this company in the singular anymore, because we are very much a group. But so, yeah, on the Continental Divide, I'd actually hiked the majority of the way with my girlfriend, Gail, who I'd met while we were hiking out there. And she was actually along with me for the ride. She'd come back to the UK in early January, and yeah, was supporting me in the early days of the business. But as we sort of moved to the Lake District and sort of started paving our future together, really.
And so, what does we consist of now? Because I know that's under 2 years, isn't it? So things have changed quite dramatically.
Yeah. So it was about August of 2018 when we took on our first member of staff, Laura, who conveniently lived in the apartment above mine, and she's a seamstress who works with costumes. So she's a costume designer at the theatre in Keswick. And then we picked up there's somebody else that comes in. My friend Justin comes and helps us out over the winter. He's an outdoor instructor, and so he comes and works here 3 days a week, just to sort of keep him out of the cafes in Keswick as the work dries up over the winter. And then we got we picked up Jen, who's a Canadian girl who's now managing our admin, and she's absolutely superb. And what else do we have? Phoebe. Yeah, so there's four of us now, of a merry little gang. I met Phoebe working at Glastonbury Festival, and she's come off the back working in like super yachts and stuff, is just constantly smiling. So she's come out here and is now swimming in the lake every day, and with or without a wetsuit on, and she's just really embraced the local community.
Fantastic. Well, it sounds like you've got a really good team there now, and plenty of conversation to indulge in around the coffee machine.
The Outdoors Station is a free media entertainment service dedicated to the self-powered outdoors enthusiast.
So we've got your history. Then we started back in 2009, and we're now up to modern day. So let's just move on briefly to talk about a few things to do with PAX, if that's okay. I know certainly material manufacture is the biggest problem, one of the biggest problems for any cottage manufacturer in this country. How are you finding sourcing materials, and has it been a major headache?
So yeah, I'd say it's probably the biggest sort of obstacle to entry, the biggest barrier to entry for any company is the minimum order quantities, or the MOQ as it's known, can be really, really difficult. So, you know, there's nobody in the UK that's building lightweight specific fabrics. You know, there's quite a few mills, but they're all making sort of your 1,000 denier Corduras and that kind of thing. So, you know, it's hard to get, you know, the technical stuff. Luckily with, you know, Dimension Polynant, who make X-Pack, and, you know, the VX series of fabrics, they don't really have a minimum order quantity. So, you know, they're great. There's a lot of part of the reason why a lot of smaller companies use them is because, you know, I could call them up now and get, you know, one yard of fabric delivered to my house. It would cost me a lot, but, you know, I could do it, and they're happy to indulge. Whereas, you know, Dyneema, who make like the Dyneema composite material, you know, formerly Cuban fiber, that stuff, you know, you're looking at a small mortgage to even be allowed a seat at the table. You know, the minimum order quantity is 1500 meters per style and per color. if I wanted to, you know, stock that as an option at a price that I could afford to stock it, you know, I'd be looking at potentially laying out sort of £40,000 for just one fabric. So yeah, it has been hard, and I think we're just about there with our sort of materials and webbings and buckles and hardware and all that kind of thing. There's a lot of trial and error in, you know, just because you can buy buckles on eBay doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be of high quality. So, you know, finding the, going to the, direct to the suppliers, and, you know, making yourself sound like you're much bigger than you are, initially talking about placing orders for tens of thousands of items, but we'll just take 500 just to begin with, just to make sure that they're okay. So there's a lot of just sort of being charming, really, and sort of hoping for the best.
Are you getting your Cuban fiber, importing it from the States?
Yeah, so you know, I can get it. I cannot sell it cheaply. Like, it will probably always be cheaper to buy one direct from the US, especially if you are in the US. But I can get it here, and we just charge like a 60 pound surcharge for any pack that we consider cutting out of it. It is hard, yeah. I mean, it still cost me about 40. I think it's about, yeah, it's just over $40 a meter. So, you know, it is expensive stuff. And then by the time, you know, shipping and carriage and all that kind of thing, you know, I had one roll turned up, and the guys at customs had basically hacked into it with a machete to try and get the customs form off it, and, you know, the fabric was absolutely destroyed. You know, they'd the way they roll Cuban fiber effectively meant that they'd cut through about eight layers of the beginning, middle, and end of the roll, and yeah, it was just, there was nothing I could do with it. It was a $1,500 roll of fabric just in the bin, pretty much. So yeah, you know, it's high risk. So for a lot of companies in Europe, they're just not going to sell it. You know, Dyneema are trying to, and, you know, they have got a base in the Netherlands, and I don't know, they're hoping to move some production over here, but the sort of supply of that thing is always going to be a problem, because they, you know, they've got some really big companies like they're using huge amounts of it, so it's no longer in their interest to really sell it to the little guys, really.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting when you talk to these material manufacturers or suppliers, full stop. As you rightly say, you have to create this image that you're much bigger than you are, or that you're really going places. But the actual marketplace in the UK is always going to be fairly niche and fairly small. And it's frustrating that the companies don't understand that actually if they helped you, then you could grow the market, which will in turn help them. But they're just sort of, as you say, the minimum order quantities are just ludicrous sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, you sort of, I suppose it depends, like, who you get. And like, you know, if you send an email and it lands on the right person's desk, then yeah, you might be able to play ball. But most of the time, you're just going to get this standardized response. No, sorry, we need $50,000 before we're even going to consider it. And it's like, you know, there's currently nobody in Europe offering Cuban fiber packs, like no one. There's Laufbursch have just started, but I know that, you know, he can't be getting that material cheaply. Like, you know, when you're talking like, you know, three rolls of fabric costing more than your car, it's a horrifying thing to work with. And it's a real barrier to entry.
Just to give people an idea, just roughly off the top of your head, how much material, what's the value of the material that you've got rolled up on the shelves there at the moment?
probably, yeah, north of 15,000.
Just to give people an idea just how tough it is to actually start a cottage manufacturing of anything to do with specialist material. You know, you've got to be considering a 15 to 20K investment, and you haven't made anything.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, you can sort of play, you know, you can buy these materials, you know, by the yard. You know, there's nothing to say that it's only when you're really starting to drill down into the actual economics of the thing that it's like, right, I actually need to start making money out of this. For a long time, I was just you know, doing it for the love and probably not actually really able to turn a profit because every pack was so different and the materials were exotic. And so actually you really need to, you have to be able to start buying at that quantity. You know, probably the biggest commitment I had to make was buying 5,000 meters of webbing. 10,000 meters of webbing. I needed two different styles of webbing and I had to buy 5,000 meters of each of them. That was almost like a workshop for, it came in about 17 boxes. and that was enough. You know, I worked out it was enough. That's a lot of webbing, you know, 10 kilometers of webbing.
And the other side of it is, of course, you know, you need to have, all of a sudden, the space that you need to store all this stuff isn't cheap either, is it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why I ever thought this was going to be either fun or easy. I mean, it's definitely fun, but yeah, I mean, we're in the process of growing out of our third workshop or our third manufacturing space. So classifying the bedroom as one, the workshop by the river as the second, and this place as the third. You know, we are bumping into each other and there's just not enough space. So we are looking at a potential fourth premises and moving over Christmas, but I don't even really want to start thinking about it at this time.
I know you said to me right at the very beginning before we started recording, I thought it was a great line, that actually one of the main reasons you decided to go lighter and get lighter packs is so you can eat more food.
That's correct. Yeah, I've got a pretty high metabolism and I eat, you know, at rest I eat about 4,000 calories a day, so on a through hike I eat closer to 6,000. And the first time I went like truly what I'd consider like ultralight was on the Pacific Crest Trail. And, you know, but my main motivation for doing that was so I could hike out of town with, you know, a loaf of bread, an entire rotisserie chicken, six avocados, a tub of mayonnaise. And I'd just sit on the side of the trail, just eating these incredible sandwiches, and hikers would walk by and just be like, oh my God, like, where did you get that? And it's like, I walked it here. Because, you know, I'm very motivated by food. Well, not motivated by food, but like I need food to function. Like if I'm hungry, I'm utterly useless. Some people can really actually starve them or kind of half starve themselves really on trail and then calorie load when they get into town. And I've just never been able to do that. I have to, you know, every, you know, mile and a half, I need to eat something pretty much. So yeah, that has been a huge motivation for shedding weight, is just so I can pack more food in.
Looking at some of the interactions you're having now with customers and their expectations, are you finding you're spending a lot of time sort of educating people as regards making their expectations more realistic regarding their anticipation by getting such a lightweight pack or using lighter fabric?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've tried to make it very clear that, you know, the limitations of the materials and also the sort of expectations that need to be placed upon them as to how well they can survive in certain areas. You know, the first decision I made when starting this company was actually to go a little bit heavier than I'd gone before, because, you know, if you use an ultralight fabric in an area where it's it's going to be abraded or it's going to undertake a lot of stress, then you know it will fail. You know, it's only a matter of time until it fails, and that's why Z-Pax packs are wonderfully light, but you know they do have a high like number of failures while on trail because the material is being stressed in a way that it shouldn't be. And likewise, people are overstuffing them. People think that, right, I'll buy a lightweight pack and then that will shave 500 grams off my gear list. But I think I can still carry all this stuff. And actually, you know, yeah, they then sort of bring about the early demise of their incredibly lightweight piece of gear. So it is hard to balance people's expectations. But I think quite often when somebody comes to me with they're like, oh, you know, I want this thing that, you know, perhaps I consider isn't necessarily going to make the best bag. At the end of the day, I'm still putting my brand name on it and I'm still putting my company's reputation on the line. So I tend not to, if I think somebody's going down a path that's not going to lead to a good end product, then I'll tend to steer them away from it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, there must be an awful lot of responsibility, but also at the same time, you've got to kindly educate them to make their expectations more realistic.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a pack on the shelf here at the moment that I'm sure I'm going to get, you know, the guy's going to be upset when he receives it, because he added every single potential option that I could offer him. And, you know, as a result, you know, he's taken a very lightweight bag and it now weighs quite a lot. And, you know, this sort of specification creep does happen where people end up in, you know, in this situation that they've got, you know, what could have been a lightweight bag, but they've bolted loads of stuff to it. So it's, yeah, it is hard. I mean, I think the magic, like, we've had very few complaints so far. So I think we're obviously doing something right. I hope.
All right, good to hear. Okay, well, we're getting close to the end now. I just want to wind up with a couple of questions, actually, which have come in from listeners. The first one's George Hawksworth, who said, what's the coolest place that you've spotted your bags, one of your bags, and what's the lightest bag you've been asked to do?
The only place I've actually bumped into one on trail was actually walking on across the summit of Kinder Scout in February of this year. And this guy was walking towards me, and I was looking at the logo on his shoulder pocket and was just like, no, surely not. And as he got closer and closer, I was like, oh my God, that's a customer. No, that was a very cool feeling. But, you know, they're turning up all over, you know, we've sent them to nearly every continent now, bar Antarctica. And, you know, they're going places. Like, somebody's got one in South America now, going up Aconcagua. I can never pronounce it. There's one on, you know, doing the Annapurna circuit, you know, all over Nepal. Like, they are turning up in some very cool places. And, you know, Instagram's such an incredible thing for the source for that, because suddenly you get tagged in this image and it's like, whoa, how did that get there? Like, yeah. So yeah, you know, they are turning up in some very cool places. And especially now, as the, you know, we've now got 1,000 packs out there rattling around. So, you know, the chances of them turning up in even cooler places still is. But I always think one of the coolest things that anyone can do is just take one of our bags on a through hike. I think that's just such a privilege.
That's what they were designed for.
Yeah, it's such a privilege to be there with them and going through everything. You know, what a personal thing to choose.
The pack, as I often say to people, you know, the first couple of weeks you're carrying it, and then after that you're wearing it.
And there's
a big emotional attachment as well that goes along with it. And certainly some of my walking buddies are very much, they will wear a pack right down to the very last thread if they can, because they have an attachment with it. And it's experienced these adventures with them as well.
So with relation to the lightest pack that I've made, there's a customer named Rob who every 6 weeks or so sends me an email with some other ludicrous specification of some insanely lightweight pack that he wants. And I think the very first Cuban fiber pack that I sewed for him, and it weighed, I think, 270 grams. And he promised that he wasn't going to put it under too much stress. And yeah, so I think that's definitely the lightest one that we've made to date. But, you know, with those materials, you can get some crazy light things, but you have to have an ultralight load in order to, you know, something that lightweight cannot take more than about 8 pounds for any length of time.
I've got another question from Paul Burks, who said, have you got any future plans to expand into tents and shelters?
I would like to, yes. Right now, we are quite good at making backpacks. So what I don't want to do, if I was to, you know, it took me a couple of years to find the attention and focus and, you know, attention to detail to make the backpacks that I make. And while I could probably come up with an okay design for a you know, a tent or a tarp, I would really want to put, you know, myself, you know, a good 1,000 miles or so of testing on something like that before I brought anything like that to market. So right now, that's our kind of barrier to entry, really, is the time to make sure that product isn't just okay. It needs to be, exceptional, because there's some very good tents there out there on the market, and you know the competition's pretty hot, and you know also you know the aforementioned problems with getting hold of material.
Well, I have to say, Tom, thanks ever so much for taking the time to talk to me this evening. It's been fascinating to hear your journey, which has remarkably been a lot shorter than I anticipated. I thought you'd been making packs a lot longer than, well, sort of 18 months, really. So it's phenomenal to see the growth sort of commercially take place over that period of time. And all I can do is wish you well, and obviously the next move when you expand into a bigger workplace.
Yeah, we're gonna hopefully have a shop in Keswick. So you know the premises that I found has a small shop attached, so that's pretty exciting. So you know you may be able to come in and pick something up off the shelf. So yeah, it's the next big adventure.
I do hope you've enjoyed listening to Tom's journey, and like me, wish him every success. His packs are naturally more expensive than the current tsunami of cheap AliExpress, Amazon and eBay fodder. Cheap Chinese packs, which don't fit, fall apart, are produced in factories in their thousands by people working in unknown, possibly dubious conditions. The bottom line is, they are cheap for a reason. Let alone the environmental footprint and question mark over shipping a small bag more than halfway around the world. If you want to see more pictures of Tom and his working environment and some of the team he mentioned, then do have a look over on the outdoorstation.co.uk podcast page. However, if you want to see the packs that he makes, do pop along to atompacks.com and see for yourself the advantages of having a custom-made pack, which could be your faithful companion for many trips to come. I make no apologies for supporting and celebrating UK cottage manufacturers on the Outdoor Station. The less distance our products have to travel to get to us, and the better quality we get for our buck, will make our journeys much richer in my book. So, please do drop me feedback via whatever social media you use, and let me know your thoughts on this podcast. Thanks for listening. Until next time, folks, bye for now.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To hear or see more from our extensive free library, please visit theoutdoorsstation.co.uk.